Today's episode is brought to you by Taft Law and its Franchise Advance Program, a one-of-a-kind program developed by your host, Josh Brown, to help entrepreneurs assess, convert, and grow your business the right way through sound franchise structures. To learn more, go to taftlaw.com and type Franchise Advance Program in the search bar.
If you think like, act like, or are trying to grow like a franchise, then the Franchise Euphoria podcast is for you. Hello and welcome, everybody. Josh Brown here, and I created this podcast for one main goal: to help people who are trying to grow their business through franchising or franchise-like structures to do it the right way. I've been practicing law now as a franchise lawyer for many, many years, and I've seen it done the right way and the wrong way. And this podcast is not filled with a bunch of legal mumbo jumbo. Rather, I talk with real people, people who have been there, have done it, are doing it right now. And I also dive deep into specific topics related to franchising. So if this is of interest to you, you are at the right place. Enjoy. Thrilled to have on Andrew Podolov today from Rush Bowls. He's the CEO and founder, and he founded Rush Bowls in Boulder, Colorado, as the first all-natural bowl smoothie bar in the fall of 2004, providing a healthy alternative to the common hill fare. After enormous success, Andrew launched a line of frozen grab-and-go bowls soon to meet the ever-mounting demand. Today, he operates Rush Bowls retail, wholesaling, and franchising with over 100 stores in various stages of development throughout the U.S. Welcome, Andrew. How you doing?
Oh, it's great. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, I love having the founders on, especially because you all have a background, and usually it's not in what you're doing right now, and such is the case with you. I mean, obviously, as you talk about your background, you started in the financial sector. I'd love to hear about that and how you went from essentially the ranks of the New York City financial sector to a smoothie bar.
Yes, it's quite a fall from grace, as I joke, but I was global head of fixed income derivative trading in New York City. So I worked at all institutionally focused. I worked at started my career at Bear Stearns and then Morgan Stanley in trading derivatives, Credit Lyonnais, specializing in Canadian and dollar derivatives, 5 years in. For the dollar, and then was global head for National Australia Bank, all dollar denominated focused, all in New York City, mostly in Midtown. And for me, the trigger was fortuitously, I was pretty successful in what I was doing and did it for a while, but 9/11 really was a major trigger for me. I lived in the city during 9/11. My wife was in the tower in 93 when they first tried to bomb it. And then it was her first day back from maternity. And I was in Midtown. She was in the 20s. And she literally saw the plane crash in. I lost a close friend that day. And from that day forward, I'm like, I don't want to live in New York City anymore. And I want to do something that I have no knowledge about and build it from scratch. Fortuitously, with a great deal of financial knowledge, it afforded me the real understanding of the financials behind this business model and how to make it successful. And certainly, it's not been without its challenges, quite frankly, especially on the wholesale line.
Yeah, no, I'd love to talk about that. And by the way, I'm so sorry you guys have had to deal with that. You're about the third or fourth person I've talked with that literally a new career was spawned out of September 11th. You know, having lived through that and then just sort of realizing, you know, to a certain extent, you know, life is short, you know, go after what it is that you really want to do. Talk about how you made that transition. Because obviously, you know, going from the environment you were in, very, very fast paced, very, very stressful, high pressure packed situation, to a different kind of high pressure packed situation, right? I mean, there's nothing more pressure packed than going out and launching a career in something you essentially didn't know much about, but you're diving, you know, headfirst into.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I will tell you, I looked at risk assessment my whole life, right? I was a professional gambler for the banks and big positions. So when I did a trade in New York City, some of these trades would be on for 30 years. You can get out of it. But also, you know, there are significant positions on behalf of the bank. So it wasn't brokering things, which is different. These were positions put on for the bank because of how I foresee the markets doing. Then I realized, you know, certainly a big part of this is, hey, I look at risk assessment, take bets every day. Why not? The most important thing is you bet on yourself. So I went pretty headfirst into this. I moved to Boulder in 2004 and opened a store in 2004 simultaneously without a job because I then quit.
But how did you decide on this? Like, how did you decide on doing – like, what made you think about smoothie bowls? I mean, did you just – did you enjoy them as a customer or what kind of led you down that path? I mean, there's lots of different businesses you could have started.
You know, it's funny. There's a few things that led me down that path. A, I wanted to interact with people. I wanted to, have that consumer interaction. I missed that. When I was, running a trading desk, it was mine, yours, just very – I didn't speak to the customers at all would be – and even if I did, they're institutional banks, you know. So I missed the customer interaction. I had a friend of mine that was doing smoothies and – I did not really want to do the smoothies. I wanted to be meal focused. Now, if you go back to 04, no one was doing bowls. Like, we were the pioneer of the field.
You had to be, because now you see them all over the place. But I don't recall back in 04 ever seeing them anywhere.
No one was doing that. And for me, I'm a big texture guy. I wanted the silkiness of the fruit blended, the crunchiness of the granola, organic granola, the honey, the fresh toppings. I wanted all of that in a mouth feel that was a meal focused. I did not really focus on smoothies. I went all in on bowls. And that's hard because you have to do a big part of your job is education. What was it? And no one knew what it was, retail or wholesale at the time. I didn't launch wholesale until 7 years later and no one knew what it was. But I will tell you, I picked a college community that was pretty progressive in their thoughts. And certainly, I think starting in that place where you had a young community willing to try new things really afforded us the opportunity to kind of launch it step by step. So I wasn't like all of a sudden that, a million people knocking at the door. It was a slow and steady growth that afforded this opportunity for me.
So what was that like? 04, you kind of, I'm sure knowing your background, right? You did the research, you ran the numbers, you had your spreadsheets, you had all the metrics, you had all the data, hey, if I sell X number of bowls a day, And then it's like, what was that Mike Tyson quote? Like, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face. What was that like for you when you finally opened up the store? But did everything go as planned or did you have to, did you have to alternate a little bit?
I would say looking back at it, I probably would have done more research. But again, you're in a fine line when you do, and I'm a big research guy, especially, in a lot of levels. The data doesn't lie.
There's no way, though, right? You definitely did research, right? I cannot imagine with your background you didn't do research on this.
I did, but you don't know what you're doing until you're doing it, right? So especially when you're launching a new product line. Like, no one's ever was doing bowls. So you didn't know how people would react to it. I know I had my feeling. And early on, I felt very strongly that, I was there all the time talking to the consumers, getting a better understanding of their likes, dislikes, what worked, what didn't. For me, it was information gathering. And I knew deep down, persistence covers a lot of shortness of capability, I think. And I was extremely persistent to make sure this worked and understood the opportunity. And I saw the opportunity in front of my face. People's expressions, what they liked, they kept coming in, reordering, and growth was like slow and steady. But, at the end of the day, I was coming from global head of a trading desk to mopping floors in my own store, So it was quite a adjustment on that side.
What was that like for you psychologically?
I think it was pretty tough. You're treated like royalty, quite frankly. on the other extreme, when you're global head of a bank and coming here, you know, you're like, oh, I got to do this. I got to do this. And I knew deep down, like, even if I was digging ditches, I would do whatever I could to be successful. So I had that fire in my belly. But it was quite an adjustment, but it's also mine, you know, and ownership of a business is really rewarding.
You know, it really is. I love that you say that. Well, I mean, I love that you say that. I mean, I've owned businesses and, you know, run my own practice now, but I've actually owned businesses. And I think there is something to that, that, you know, when it's yours, when at the end of the day, your name's on it and you're signing, you know, the leases and you're signing the documents and you know that, you know, you're truly betting on yourself. Even if you're sitting there, Andrew, mopping the floor, you know, there's a sense of satisfaction there because there's an opportunity for it to become something that either you dreamed of or something bigger than you could ever dream of.
And certainly that was the case. I never, you know, really look back at it in terms of, oh, what I do this. I always look forward. And quite frankly, we do this, you know, I look at the business and I'm constantly looking at the business and ways to improve, not for just us, but for our partners and that's the franchisees, to make us a better company. And we do a lot of things in a unique fashion to make our franchisees have an opportunity at more success than most companies out there. Also, we're unique. Also, Josh, you appreciate this. We're privately held. There's no private equity. Everything was self-funded. We're a profitable business, which is very unusual on this size and scope of a business. So,
oh, no, that's awesome. I love that. I mean, you have total control over it. I mean,
yes. And my objective is different than generally private equity, right? I'm here for the long-term success opposed to venture capital or private equity, 2-3 year timeline, spin you in and out. And you know, their objectives may not lie in the success of the partners.
Yeah, it's a really good point because most people don't understand, you know, there's this aura around private equity or injection of capital into your business. And at the end of the day, there's benefits to that, obviously. You know, it does give a lot of businesses an opportunity to expand and grow faster, and there's nothing wrong with that. But there's also downsides to that. I mean, you know, when you do that, usually in these type of businesses, to your point, you know, somebody like yourself who's built this thing with your own equity, with your own money, with your own sweat and tears, and you know everybody, and you're there through the thick and thin of it. At the end of the day, their objective is whatever they paid for it, they're coming in to make a multiple on that within usually 3 to 5 years. And that's their assessment, right? Hey, we can come in, we can inject this amount of equity, we're going to grow it to this level. And at that point in time, usually, your impact, your input, as the founder and the owner kind of takes a back seat to what their interests are. And a lot of owners don't understand that. A lot of people who build businesses don't understand that. Now, part of that is sometimes they just get so cash strapped that they're forced into it. They need somebody to come in, or they're at that inflection point where they want to grow. And they can see the on the other side of the hill, but they just can't quite get there. So you were in a good spot where you didn't need that. Now, maybe down the road somebody comes, who knows, right? I mean, you never say never, but that probably afforded you a lot of opportunities to do things continuously in your own vision versus to having to adopt somebody else's.
Yeah, and I that's dead on, really. You know, it affords me not to compromise some of the things that a lot of companies will compromise on a short-sighted view, and we don't.
Well, first and foremost, quality, right? I mean, that always seems to take a – it's amazing to me how a business – you see it all the time. You see these businesses, and they built themselves on fresh, good ingredients, quality. And the first thing somebody does when they come in is, how can we cut costs on that? Well – sometimes you can't cut costs in that way. You got to cut costs in another way.
Or you sector yourself as, you know, higher end, and we're a higher end product too. But for instance, on something that most people don't even think about, and I know you're a franchise attorney with your own practice, this is unusual, but we don't, a lot of franchises out there, they charge the franchisees for food. So they are buying from the franchisor. In our particular business model, we don't make any money on food or equipment. So we have national suppliers. If there's rebates associated to that, it goes directly back to our partners or franchisees. Same thing with equipment. So most of these, the dirty little secret sometimes is a lot of these franchises, and Quiznos was famous for this, but they made more money on the food than even the royalties. So that I always...
And that's always a problem, right? That's always, to me, that's always a problem because that's where your interests don't align at that point. If you're right, I mean, if your interests align to a certain degree, to a significant degree, when it's royalty based, because the better you do, the better they do. But if there's these rebates and they, you know, they're making their money off of food or they're making their money in other ways, and then the interests get a little bit askew. Was this something that you always sort of thought about as you were developing the franchise system, or what led you to think, hey, we're going to go ahead and give these rebates back to the franchisees?
Especially for a new franchise system. And we started this in 2016. I can go back to the other stuff at, you know, what we did in between, but their success is really truly our success. So you don't want to burden these systems with a lot of costs that they don't need. And this business model is based on efficiency and finance, right? Not just creativity. And you know, certainly that's a big area that I always love about the job. But so you have to be really efficient and you can't burden people with these costs. It's, you know, hard enough in today's world to, you know, do really well. A franchise system affords you a formulaic approach to it, which I think I would never buy anything but a franchise system for my own personal gain because it's so hard to build a business from scratch. But to be able to have it structured in such a way to afford people the opportunity to, you know, have an efficient business model without being burdened by costs is a big deal. Now, as you get to 100, 200, 500,000 stores, that may change because your buying power gets that much more significant. But I am still never looking to have that as a profit center. And I don't think it's fair to the franchisees to do it that way unless you're saving them such a significant amount of money. You know, so that's, you know, that's a big deal
for us. So when your first store you opened in 2004. Now, you franchised in 2016. Was it always your hope and thought that you were going to franchise eventually, or did that come to you through customers mentioning it to you or just through your own growth?
You know, a lot of it, I pushed it off. Everyone, even early on, you should franchise. And as you know better than anyone, that's quite a process and quite of a hole to go down into. And I wanted to do it when I felt we would test the market in another retail store and roll it out in a manner that, you know, would be the most productive way of doing it, opposed to just doing it on the fly. And there's plenty of companies that do it on the fly. But I look at things in a much more pragmatic approach and don't want to, you know, do in a half-cocked approach. And in 2010 to 2016, I launched a wholesale company of selling frozen bowls, mainly in Whole Foods on a wholesale level. And we were in 40 states with that. So that was a big time in my focus. Unfortunately, and this was a great learning experience also, my co-packer overnight went out of business. He literally got arrested and closed a whole factory down, and I couldn't support it anymore with the stores, even though to this day we have demand for it. And that was a great education process because I had to learn how to, you know, explain what the bowl was. And still in 2010, no one was doing bowls, really, very, very few people. As a matter of fact, most of the companies out there today that do it were copies of, that came into my store, try to copy it or whatever else, were copies of the original store that's still in business today, and this original corporate store.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at your website, and it's got this great video, and it's quite frankly making me hungry, Andrew. It makes me want to come get one of those bowls. They look delicious. And you know, you're right. I mean, there's a variation of this now in several different concepts. Number one, I want to answer me this. You had to educate the market. Obviously, you were a little bit benefited from the fact that you're in Colorado, a progressive area. So there's maybe a little less education. But what was that process like? I mean, part of it is probably exciting, a kind of a new concept. Maybe you're able to get some buzz for it. But at the same time, you're still having to educate a market as to basically say, like, hey, this is a substitute. I mean, this could be your lunch. This could be your breakfast. This is, you know, this is healthy for you. Now, what was that whole process like for you to educate the market?
You know, it's, in looking back at it, and certainly it's easy to see 2020, educating a marketplace is a very costly endeavor and generally not something you want to do. It's hard to create a whole new line of food, and that's what we did. You know, so education was fun and we got better and better at it, especially when we launched the wholesale line. Because even when we launched the wholesale line, it was an interesting facet because it was we froze them, and the ideology came from getting people in and out of the retail store faster. But we had to kind of explain what it was. In certain areas of the country, and this is still going back, didn't really know what mango was, right? It was an exotic fruit. Like, what is that? Or acai or hemp granola, right? Like, hemp granola. Oh, no, I'm going to get stoned from eating hemp seed. Like, and that's the truth of it. Like, people were confused. So it really helped us develop. And when we launched franchising, I already had a really strong understanding of national distribution, how to get products to different people and raw goods, and how to do it effectively and cost in a cost-effective manner to anywhere in the country. We're in 21 states and maybe 1, 2, 3, 5 stores. I'm not sure, you know, in each state may be different, but that's a really big network of states to deal with. On top of that, you really have to understand the challenges of each state and then how to get the word out in each state. And I felt there's a real competitive advantage we have because it's a lot easier to do a super regional, right? And no one was doing it well on a national level. And I still don't think anyone's doing it well on a national level. And I feel there's a big opportunity for us to kind of, I hate to use the word exploit, but take advantage of that fact for the betterment of the communities.
Well, other than being first mover, right, in this sector and category, what else differentiates you from your competitors?
You know, that's an easy one, and I feel that the competitors are making a big mistake here, many of them. We don't do, like, scoopable. See, a lot of them now do sorbets, basically. So we're only really all-natural fruit, vegetables, with a base of, you know, 100% juice, milks, oat milk, coconut, whatever it may be, almond. And we don't adulterate it with other stuff. Most of the competitors out there are using a scoopable version. So they use like a sorbet, which is high in sugars, has, you know, all sorts of fillers in it. And we don't go that direction. It affords us the opportunity to, A, be a better tasting product because it's not so sweet or has, you know, guar gums and has stabilizers in it. But it also can accommodate almost any dietary need. So we're making it from soup to nuts in front of you. And if you're gluten-free, dairy-free, vegan, whatever your heart, whatever dietary need you may need, we have a product and you're not paying extra for it because I don't feel people should be punished because they have a dietary need. So everything is really made to order on the fly under 2 minutes or less. So we really have it dialed down to a science. When people are looking to have cheaper, less quality, we're, you know, staying true to our roots, and that's why it tastes better. That's why we also focus on bowls and smoothies and complementary products. We're not a deli. So the first inclination for companies, especially if not selling as well as they should, is, hey, let's launch sandwiches. Let's do this. Let's do soup. Let's do pasta. Let's do coffee. And you're not good at that. That's not your strength, and it dilutes the positioning of the brand. We focus on bowls and smoothies because we're the best at it in the marketplace. And fortuitously, we created the marketplace. Beyond that, we do products that complement it in a smaller square footage. So, you know, we look for 1,000 square feet or less. We're not big, you know, hang in there all day.
I love, can we pause there for a second? I love that. So big mistake lots of franchisors make, and then they push on their franchisees as they get too much space. I cannot say that enough. The difference between many franchisees in franchise systems, the difference between them succeeding and failing is they have too much damn space. And it drives me nuts when I see a franchisor and they just don't understand the metrics of leasing space and the fact that when you tie your franchisee into a 10, 15, 20 year term, you're also tying them into a 10, 15, 20 year lease. And if you get the space size wrong, they are screwed. So I'm of the opinion, candidly, for a place like this, I'd rather have less space and feel a little squeezed than have 200 or 300 extra square feet that's going to kill my profitability.
100% right. And it's easier to find the bigger spaces, and the brokers or the real estate people make more money on it. It's a cost of the process. And that's why we're really about efficiency of the business model. So 30 to 60% of our business is driven by, you know, takeout orders or delivery, right? I don't need a lot of space for delivery orders, right? Beyond that, you know, the customer area is very small in our spaces. It's in and out, high volume, high quality. And that's our focus. So 100% what you're saying, obviously, I think a lot of people that make that mistake. And I do my best, especially early on with our franchisees. I'm very involved with, you know, letter of intent. I'm very involved with the lease. I look at the leases myself. And have attorneys look at the leases for, you know, on behalf of the franchisees. They have their own attorneys, but I'll make more comments than their attorneys. Because ultimately it's really imperative that there's a financial component to this of what makes sense, especially, you know, if it's 5 years, 10 years, you know, whatever that commitment may be.
Absolutely. Well, in our remaining couple minutes here, I want you to talk about the type of franchisees you're looking for and that you hope to do well in your system. But if anybody wants to learn more about the system, about the franchise, you can go to rushbowls.com. That's rushbowls.com. But Andrew, let's finish this up by talking about the type of franchisees that you're looking for and that you would like to continue to grow the system.
Sure. And that's kind of an easy one for me because I don't really care if this person or people have food experience. It, to me, it's business acumen. So having business experience, maybe owning their own business, maybe working corporate America. Listen, I worked in corporate America for a long, long time. But it's an understanding of their community. It's an understanding of an appreciation of healthy, nutritious food. But it's also having understanding of how businesses operate. And you have to operate a restaurant, because how we're structured, it's pretty plug and play. We're a very modular system and everything is kind of pre-programmed. So it's really reaching your community and getting in people's mouths and feeling good about the products you're serving to your community. And it may be communities that are not your typical communities. Like we launched a store in Birmingham, Alabama, and we just launched one of our biggest openings ever in Visalia, California. They're not known as health food capitals of the world, but there's opportunity because there's so few in those communities, and you feel great about reaching those communities because you can really have another opportunity for people to eat healthy and nutritious food. And we're not preachy about it. You want Nutella on top, have Nutella on top, but you know the base and the things that we're putting in, you can see with your own eyes. There's no back of the room scooping something, whatever, you know, and just really in front of your eyes, nutritious food on the go. So,
well, thank you so much, Andrew, for coming on. I can hear your passion for this through the microphone, which is wonderful, and I can tell that, you know, you're doing and you're trying to do things the right way. And in my experience, when you do that, you ultimately find your way to very successful outcomes. So continue to do what you're doing. And I'm actually going to be in Colorado in, when's that going to be? I think August or September. And if I'm nearby, I'm going to swing into your Rush Bowl there and check it out.
Well, we have a ton opening, and we have a lot in Colorado. So no matter where you are, hopefully I can meet up with you. But if not, you know, we probably have a Rush Bowls near you. I know we have a ton in Denver. We're opening a bunch.
Oh, yeah, you got one in Bloomington, you said, right? So you got one in Bloomington. I got to try that as well. So thank you so much for coming on. A fascinating, great story. And I'm thrilled for all your success.
And thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for tuning into another episode of Franchise Euphoria. If you enjoyed it, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and review. It really helps to get this show out to more and more people. Also, if you have any questions, have ideas for guests or topics, please email me, josh@indyfranchiselaw.com. That's josh@indyfranchiselaw.com. And finally, please note that this podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes and is not in any way, shape, or form meant to be any kind of legal advice. If you're seeking legal advice, please contact a lawyer. Have a great one. Happy franchising.